Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 3rd of May, 2023, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index. And we're here to talk about the construction industry. Not that we've had much time to talk about it over the last 2 weeks, as there's been a bank holiday every other day, hasn't there, Phil? And we've got more to come.
Yeah, the whole country's gone part-time.
Yeah.
I sort of approve.
I suppose you reach a certain age, Phil, and you wish that more days were bank holidays. I wish that had happened back in my 20s, though.
Well, yes. Right, so what are we going to talk about today, David?
Well, a bit of a blast from the past, or rather it's sort of, is it new wine in an old bottle? We're going to talk about integrated project delivery, which rose to the surface last week or the week before when National Highways, the government outfit that looks after our trunk roads and motorways, announced that it was going to adopt this new concept of integrated project delivery in all of its projects, and that it wanted all of its suppliers to buy into it. Well, they have to buy into it. Not only that, it wants key players within each of its suppliers to take an exam, to sit an exam, so that they are qualified in integrated project delivery. And to begin with, I have to say, I had no idea what integrated project delivery was until I started to read about it a little bit, and I recognised it immediately. It was what we used to call partnering.
You say that, and that was my first reaction, is it, you know, partnering 2.0 or 3.1 or whatever.
Yeah.
It's a bit more than that. I did a bit of homework, and I had a email exchange with Martin Perks, who's the Commercial Improvement and Innovation Director at National Highways, who's I don't know if this is specifically his brainchild or whether it's something that he's adopted, inherited, and is running with it. He's leading the drive at National Highways towards integrated project delivery, and he was saying that it's already been quite well adopted in North America and Finland. I don't quite know why Finland, but he mentioned that country. So I did a bit of Googling, and it all comes out in the USA. It all stems from Toyota and lean manufacturing. Yeah. Now, of course, we had Egan reporting back in 20 years ago or so in this country. And he came from Jaguar. So, but I think we know that Toyota kind of trumps Jaguar when it comes to manufacturing.
Yes, all this lean business, that was a Toyota's thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. Improvement and all this, that and the other. So it's IPD, integrated project delivery, is a part of lean manufacturing. And yes, it's more than alliances is in the past we've thought about. It's been to do with open book accounting where the client and the contractor and the client's design team, get together, contractor involved early. Everyone knows how much money everyone's going to do, to make all the savings that are shared between all the parties. So it's removing the adversarial bit of construction, which has been deemed to have blighted the industry for so long. What IPD does is it goes much further. It brings in the supply chain. It brings in the subcontractors and the sub-subcontractors. All come into the project together, so they're all working together. And what it all seems to rely on is the behaviours, the personalities, the characteristics of the individuals involved. They've got to, get with the programme and realise that you're not wearing your corporate hat, you're wearing your project hat. Your first responsibility is the success of the project, not the success of your boss or your shareholders or your owners or your own business. And that does require a cultural shift. And this is why Martin Perks, he sort of put out this article explaining why IPD was a great thing. And in amongst that, he sort of said, and that's why we need everyone to sit the exam. They need people to have the tools, I'm trying to find the exact quote, but it's basically by sitting the exam, and they're working on the aspiration is to create a special diploma in IPD.
Mm-hmm.
And I bet it won't be called they'll be called a black belt in IPD, a Six Sigma black belt in IPD.
It did start in Japan, didn't it?
Or something like this. So if people get trained in it. And there's bound to be, just as when within the old digger drivers were told they've got to pass a test and get a card, they go, why do I have to be, you know, have some young whippersnapper know nothing, watch me operate a digger to tell me whether I should be allowed to drive a digger or not when I've been doing it for decades. There will mm-hmm. be people in the construction industry to go, well, I know how to do my job. Why do I have to sit another exam? But there'll be others who will think it'd be great to have their employees pay for them to get another qualification and more initials after their name. And so I can imagine there'll be good buy-in to this ultimately, by and large.
I guess so. I mean, a lot of what you said, although you say that it goes an awful lot further than what we used to call partnering, I mean, the principle hasn't changed at all. It's all about people getting together and working as a team towards a common goal. And, the whole idea of partnering was that, you know, you are no longer just a Bovis person or a Carillion person or a Costain person. You were actually, a Crossrail person or whatever it was. You know, you were working on a project and your colleagues, there was virtually no sort of corporate separation between people working on the team. So you'd be maybe co-located with people from the designer, from the engineer, from the client. You'd all be working in the same office. You wouldn't be working in a contractor's office or an engineer's office or an architect's office like that. And I suppose what this does is extend it further down the supply chain. So maybe, you know, that your widget supplier would be IPD qualified.
But that's significant. If you go into a big building site that, you know, whatever Costain is managing, there might only be three Costain people there, and two of them are working from home. And the real work is being done by, you know, Costain may have the risk and the liability and important stuff like that, but the real work is being done by subcontractors. So it's, I think, to suggest that bringing in the subcontractors and the supply chain is a small next step, I think is underselling it. I think it's quite a big next step.
Oh, right. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I think what John Prescott would have called a step change, in fact, back in the day.
Would he? Did he know words like that?
Yeah, he was always talking about step change because, of course, John Prescott, back in the Blair government, being Deputy Prime Minister, he was the one who was always wheeled out when we were talking about construction and the rest of it, and so he was quite visible. But he was always talking about step changes. I think it was the first time I ever heard the phrase, and I couldn't. I thought to begin with, I thought it was something that Prescott had made up because he was quite famous for speaking in riddles, not intentionally, of course, but just garbling his speech. And I thought a step change was something that Prescott had invented. But yeah, what he would have called this a step change because it's a major step towards something bigger or better. So yeah, I think it is quite interesting. What makes me slightly skeptical about it is that the whole idea of partnering, which was universally approved of, I think, by all the great and good in the construction industry in the early 2000s, worked up to a point. And then we got the global financial crisis in 2007, 2008. And that all went by the board. And we were back to the old adversarial way of doing things because everybody was hunkering down and making sure they were looking after their own people and their own shareholders, of course. And so partnering really didn't, I think it sort of withered on the vine a bit. Maybe this is just a revival of the same thing, but taking it to the next step. I guess that is what it is. Whether or not it will succeed, I don't know.
Well, National Highways, I think, have been doing a lot in this sort of alliancing field, as have the water companies. I mean, the water companies also, for all we quite rightly slag them off for all the bad things they do. When it comes to procurement, they've actually been quite progressive, new engineering contract, and they've embraced mm-hmm. things like that for many years, and alliances and partnerships. And we saw on the A14 job, National Highways brought together, it's initially led to three major contracts, and they brought the three of them. I still don't fully understand exactly how that worked. I've never read a proper explanation of it, but broadly speaking, by bringing the three contractors together into a single A14 team, that is seen to have been a significant contributing factor to the delivery of that project. I think it was on time and probably broadly on budget. I don't know exactly on budget.
I think it was. I mean, it was certainly a big feather in their cap at the time, back when there were Highways England back then, I think. But yes, that was always held up as a great exemplar of the new way of doing things. I suppose, yes, that must have been integrated project delivery, though I don't remember them calling it that back then. I might be wrong.
Having said all of this, of course, there won't be any roads being built
when this
comes in 2025. So they'll have plenty of time to sit around in teams doing team building exercises and playing board games together to get to know each other, because there'll be no construction work to do for them.
Well, certainly not as much as we were expecting them to do after the last couple of weeks' news. I suppose they've still got to maintain structures and stuff like that. There'll still be some work going on, obviously.
You reckon?
Well, there are some projects that are currently underway which have got to be finished.
Yes, but they're already going. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing will change that, I don't think.
Well, I suppose if nothing else, it'll give them something else to think about while they're waiting for the next contract.
You know, interesting stuff. What my only fear is, it becomes a gravy train for the diploma farms. I kind of said to ask National Highways whether they would have a finger in the pie. Is that the right expression? Of the diploma, do they get 10% of every diploma that's awarded? Can it be a money making scam for someone? I'm sure it won't be.
Well, I mean, there are plenty of training providers out there who will be able to whip up a syllabus for integrated project delivery qualifications in no time at all, I should think. They'll be clamouring to get the work.
Should we move on to our next topic?
Yeah, let's do that, yeah. Well, this is the latest bit of news in the fallout from the Grenfell fire back in 2017, isn't it? It's the publication, the government has finally published a report that they commissioned a couple of years ago from Paul Morrell, his quantity surveyor, and barrister Annalise Day. And it's all about product testing. So tell us a bit about that, Phil.
Yes, well, as I don't think anyone needs reminding, one of the biggest scandals of the Grenfell Tower fire was the discovery that products were used in a way that they were not suitable for. It was the combination of the cladding panels, the aluminium cladding panels, with the fixings and the insulation behind it and the connections and this, that and the other, and the smoke, as we know, roared up the inside of the panels, which acted like a chimney as an accelerant, and smoke went everywhere and spread the fire far more rapidly than anyone had been led to believe would happen. It emerged that all sorts of dodgy things have been going on with essentially with the marketing of construction products and the massaging of certificates and approvals and things like that. And all sorts of people have been found to at fault. Anyway, so this review was commissioned by the government. As you mentioned, Paul Morrell, who's a quantity surveyor, he's previously been the government's chief construction advisor. I don't know if that post still exists, actually, but he had that post for a while. And he's a quantity surveyor from one of the big QS firms previously when he was in full-time work. And this barrister, Annalise Day, so they've got construction expertise and legal expertise to look at the whole system of how construction products are tested. And it's a massive report, 174 pages, and it's come out and everyone's saying this is a seminal piece of work. Everyone needs to read it. Have you read it?
I've read bits of it, Phil. I haven't read every single page, I have to confess.
No, I've said I haven't either. I've introduction and conclusions and I've highlighted what I think are some particularly interesting findings. Mm-hmm. And essentially, this document, this review of how we go about in the UK testing construction products. If I was the lawyers for the Grenfell Tower refurbishment contractors or designers, architects, I would be picking up this report with glee, saying, I've got to get out of jail free card here. Because what this document says, this big report says, is basically the process at the moment is so complex that hardly anyone understands it. It's completely unclear, mm-hmm. and completely inconsistent. At which point, you know, Ryden and the architects and all the other consultants can go, see, not our fault, Gov. It's a system that's at fault. And they've got a lot of ammunition in that claim, which is surely what they will be claiming. How can we possibly be expected to understand such a complicated system? And it's all the fault of the product manufacturers who missold us their stuff.
Hmm.
Now, systemic issues that this review has found, I'm just going to quote a couple of paragraphs. The most obvious gap in the current system is that only construction products for which there is a designated standard are covered by the construction products regulation. Anecdotal estimate is that this accounts for about one third of all construction products in manufacture. Therefore, we've got something like 20,000 to 30,000 construction products are completely unregulated, outside the scope of any regulation.
Yeah.
He goes on to say, the regulation was primarily designed for the purpose of creating a level playing field for a single market and not for ensuring a safe or sustainable product or building, nor anything else not specifically covered in an annex to the applicable standards. As a consequence, and with respect to our terms of reference, there isn't actually a specific UK system for testing the safety of construction products. Rather, there is a system for assessing conformity to whatever performance requirements are set down in the standards. Now, I think you and I have talked about in the past about standards, where it becomes a horse trading between the Italians and the French and the Germans and the British. What should put in the standard? And, oh, we'll go for that. There might be some things in the standard which one country think go too far and another country think don't go far enough. And they compromise and go, OK, let's say this is the standard. And then we're all trading internationally across the single Europe on a level playing field.
Yeah.
But no one's saying this standard defines best practice and safety or absolute safety. And therefore, when you test a product, as this report says, there is no construction products are not tested for safety. That is not part of anything.
No.
They're only tested for conformity to a broadly, I want to say arbitrary. Is that too strong a word? Arbitrary standard? Certainly a horse-traded standard.
I don't think it's arbitrary. Yes, exactly. I mean, I think there was a phrase which I picked out, which is probably in the next paragraph to yours, which says that the regulation, construction products regulation, was primarily designed for the purpose of creating a level playing field for a single market. Now, I suppose this is obviously music to the ears of the Brexiteers by saying, you know, we had to compromise on safety because we had to take
into
account.
Oh, bollocks to that. Listen, because even before we were in negotiations with other countries setting standard, even when you set the British standard, you'd have, you know, manufacturer A who was good at one particular widget versus manufacturer B whose thing was another particular widget sitting around a table. And they'd argue that, you know, something should be in the standard. And the other company would say, well, that shouldn't be in the standard because you've got the patent on that and only you can make that. So we don't accept. So even if the standard is just a Sheffield standard or a little village standard, there are going to be people in that village arguing about what should be in the standard. So just because there are some Johnny foreigners in there doesn't mean say it's any more of a compromise than it would be in a British standard.
No, I take your point, but it still means that there's some compromise involved and that the main preoccupation was to please everybody who's involved rather than to concentrate on the safety of a building.
Yes, no, that's absolutely true. I just don't want anyone to suggest that Brexit's got anything to do with this.
No.
Or the EU.
No. Somebody will say that, though.
Well, I hope I've seen them right.
Well, yeah. The thing which surprised me was that, I mean, I think I really understood that. It hadn't been laid out for me specifically in such an uncompromising way. But what really surprised me was how few construction products are covered by standards and covered by the construction products regulations. I mean, it's only about a third of the available products, so which is astonishing. So basically, I mean, I think the recommendation is that they need a new, well, they say they need a new regulatory regime and two new regulators to oversee it. Let me see. A national regulator for construction products.
Before we get on to the whole new regulatory regime, I just want to pick up on your point about only a third of products are have any sort of standard attached to them. That is only part of the story, because what we saw at Grenfell was not just the products, but the combination of products. Because when you put, you know, a gearbox, a steering wheel, a camshaft and a seatbelt together, you get, and other things, all these products together, you get a motor car, which is the product in its own right. Mm-hmm. And there are many in the construction context, as we saw at Grenfell, you might have standards for the components, but not for the finished whole.
Yeah, the assembly. Yeah.
So, anyway, you're talking about the regulatory regime that they recommend.
Well, yes. This is an entirely new system which is being proposed, a new regulatory regime, two new regulators, national regulator for construction products, and a new building safety regulator, basically HSE. Of course, we know about that. They also recommend requirements for manufacturers to share technical documentation and information with the National Regulator for Construction Products and or enforcement authorities. So basically, this regulator has to be kept fully informed at all times as to what these products are and what they do and what their safety profile is.
You were mentioning some of the recommendations. This review seems to give quite a fair wind to the proposed Code for Construction Product Information, which we've talked about before, which I find quite surprising given such an eminent barrister is on board with this, because she would, I would have thought, be completely aware that we already have a code for construction product information, and it's called the Business Protection for Misleading Marketing Regulations 2008. Everything that code that the Construction Products Association has come up with, is proposing, is already in existing regulations, it seems to me. And we've talked before about how it was the bad actors, the construction product manufacturers, who came up with this big idea to make sure that no one thinks that construction product manufacturers are bad guys by getting everyone to sign a bit of paper saying, we promise to stop lying.
Yes.
Well, they're already not allowed to lie, and they were lying anyway, and there are sanctions against them for that if they do that, and that didn't work. So how an industry scheme would be any better than government regulations and have any more power and force, I fail to see. I'm lost on that one.
No, I don't understand that, unless it's simply to try and provide some transparency or, you know, sort of bring this to the surface rather than...
It's the opposite, though. It provides a cloak. It provides a cloak to hide under, I think.
Yeah, I suppose it does. What other recommendations are there that...
There's an awful lot in this report. And I think it's better on pointing out the deficiencies of where we are now than on sorting out where we go next, because it's inevitably going to be complex. So anything that this review suggests is going to be complicated. But it's all about recommendations of signposting and transparency and cooperation and government setting leadership in procurement and standards and so on. But inevitably, everyone's saying what a great document it is. The Construction Products Association is rubbing its hands with glee that its code for construction project, code for construction products, a marketing code, has had such a fair wind into its sails.
Yes.
Michael Gove has welcomed it. He's the Secretary of State, as we all know. We recognise historic failings in the system by which construction products were tested, assured and made available for sale, he says. And we've seen the tragic evidence of that all too clearly. And Gove says that the next step is going to set out proposals for reform of the UK construction product regime in due course, whenever that is.
Yeah.
Nothing is off the table as we consider this new regime. And I welcome contributions from all who share our goal of a safer built environment.
Yeah, I mean, Gove has been pretty tough on this from the word go, hasn't he? He's been rattling his sabre at the developers, at the product manufacturers, everybody involved, actually, following the Grenfell Tower. And I think one thing which is certain is that this report does show that the current testing regime is totally inadequate. It doesn't really provide the end user with anything of value. All it does is it gives, a free pass to the manufacturers of products. If they manage to get through the testing regime, which they themselves have had a hand in developing, then they can sell their products for the purpose that they intend. So it's the intended use is not being contested. It's the suitability, which is really at the heart of this. I mean, Gove said that it is unacceptable that cladding and insulation manufacturers have neither acknowledged their part in the legacy of unsafe buildings in the United Kingdom, nor contributed to the cost of remediating buildings. So, I mean, that's his position, and he made that perfectly clear. And I think that, you know, we're going to see one way or another a very far-reaching change in the way products are tested and approved for usage. And I think it could go very, very wide as well.
You know, one of my favourite subjects is the whole hype surrounding modern methods of construction.
Oh, yes.
Prefabs, yes. In other words. Modern methods of construction can mean all sorts of things, but one particular type is the volumetric, whether it's a flat pack house made in a factory which you glue together on site, or whether it's an entire house that you stick on back of a lorry and you simply crane it into place ready built, sometimes with plumbing and TVs and bedroom furniture all in place already at the most Chinese end of the spectrum. Anyway, this week's story is that Persimmon, who we know have got bags of cash,
have spent
£25 million of their loose change on a, I don't know what size of share, but I think moderately significant share of one of these volumetric house builders, Top Hat. We talked before about, and I'm trying to think of the one that come to mind, Top Hat, Ilkey.
Yes, Ilkey is another big one.
Legal and General. Mm-hmm. I've got their factory in, they're near Selby, aren't they? Ilkey are in Knaresborough.
Yeah.
And Top Hat are in Derbyshire. Although they've got another big factory in the works to open up sometime this year, next year in Corby, which will give them production capacity of 4,500 units per year. So Persimmon have said, yep, we like the idea of getting involved in this market. We can see its future. We're going to buy them. And it's quite interesting. I mean, Top Hat are hugely ambitious. They've got their principal shareholder is Goldman Sachs.
Mm.
Although curiously, I discovered Top Hat is immediately owned by Ainsco Holdings.
Ainsco?
As in Martin, Brendan, James Ainsco, the Ainsco brothers who are the Wigan Standish crane hire family.
Really? I never knew that.
Well, they're actually nothing to do with Martin Ainsco or the Ainsco family.
No, because they sold the business a long time ago.
Yeah. Ainsco Holdings is sold by the brothers to whoever. And Goldman Sachs vehicle bought Ainsco Group Holdings. And when Goldman Sachs then bought Top Hat, they used Ainsco Group Holdings as their vehicle to do this.
Right, okay.
Don't know why, whether it's all to do with cross-management of tax liabilities or something. I'm sure there's some very clever reason. But I just thought, I was intrigued when I was looking at what the ownership structure of Top Hat was. And you have to go back a few steps to get to Goldman Sachs. But the first name above Top Hat is Ainsco. And I thought, gosh. Anyway, we've mentioned also before that the cost, the money that's going into these hugely ambitious volumetric house builders Top Hat has had 300 million injected to it by shareholders in the past 18 months. And I just want to look up. I think they reported previously that their annual losses a couple of years ago were three times their sales.
Right.
Now their annual loss is about 1.5 times their sales. So, you know, every 100 quid they make, they're losing 150 quid, basically. Mm. So it's hugely, hugely expensive startup.
Yes.
And they said last year that it'd be 2025 before they get into, before they start making money. I would be surprised it would be quicker than that. Here we go. I've got it. The turnover in their last financial year, fiscal 2021, year to October 2021, they had sales of 12.4 million and lost £18 million.
Right.
So it's not a big, at the moment, it's not a big company, but there's a lot of money being spent on it. Mm. As I say, £300 million has been pumped into it just in the past 18 months. So I find the whole ambition and the dream of the of these modular construction, modular house builders, interesting. Mm. The gamble. We've seen a few go bust already of unable to keep pumping money in quick enough. And what made me think, what I thought of when I read about Persimmon buying into Top Hat, two thoughts occurred. One is that ISG actually took a majority, I think it wasn't 100%, but it was almost 100% basically, of ESS. It's an Irish company, but it's got manufacturing in Britain as well, businesses that it's acquired. ISG bought ESS last year, March last year. Because it wanted, no, ESS, we're not talking so much about the volumetric house building here, but it's the wider offsite
MMC type thing, yeah.
They saw this as ISG is not a house builder in the way that Persimmon is, not a volume house builder. It's a general contractor, it does all sorts of things, but it's in general construction. And it saw ESS as a great way of leveraging expertise in offsite construction into what it does. But very rapidly after buying ESS, ISG, well, I don't know if it's ISG who realised this or ESS who realised this, but between them, they worked out that maybe it wasn't a marriage made in heaven after all, because ESS found that there were potential customers who regard ISG as competition and perhaps weren't keen to put money ISG's way suddenly, they decided that they'd actually have more scope to make money outside of ISG than within it. So
they hived it off.
The solution they came to is ISG's parent company, and I don't know how you pronounce this, Cathexis, but it's the Texan oil billionaire's vehicle. They pulled ESS out of ISG, separated it, still under the same parent ownership, but as a sister company rather than a subsidiary, because they figured it would be more attractive to its potential customers if it wasn't part of ISG.
Yeah.
Now, I wonder whether Top Hat might find the same thing as well. If any other traditional house builder is wanting to buy some prefabs to top up a site,
they won't want to buy them from Persimmon.
Exactly. Yeah. They'll go to Legal & General or Ilkley or someone else. So it would be interesting to see whether this backfires for Top Hat and for Persimmon.
Hmm. Doesn't Persimmon already have some involvement in off-site manufacture? I know they make their own bricks, or they have made their own bricks in the past.
I'm not up to speed on their brick making, but a lot of them have the timber frame capabilities.
Yes, that's true.
But that's different. I mean, yes, apparently it's very modern to make a timber frame. Therefore, that counts as the modern method of construction.
Yes.
But timber frames is a different kettle of fish from entire prefab.
I'm not particularly familiar with Top Hat's product. I mean, they're volumetric, are they, rather than
it rolls off the production line, or it can do, like, as a fully finished, it looks like a house.
So you just wheel it onto site and then plumb it in, I assume. I think that the established house builders, the leading house builders, are pretty resistant to off-site or modern methods of construction. Well, I think maybe not. They're not so resistant to it. It's that their customers are.
It's their customers. Most people want to buy a house that looks like a house. And
when
you slam your fist against the wall in anger, it doesn't go through into the next door neighbour's living room.
which is fair comment.
And I don't know if I'm being unfair to these. I've been asking all sorts of these prefab companies if I can come and look around your factories, please. And none of them have let me yet. I think they probably sniffed my cynicism. But I can't help feeling that, I mean, I get that these buildings are net zero, they're well insulated, they are completely different from the 1950s, late 40s, post-war prefabs that were, you know, asbestos sheet type things that were shoved up to solve a housing crisis.
Most of which are listed buildings these days anyway.
Yeah. But your likes of your Simmons and your Barclays are the sharp end of capitalism, where the free market, who know their customers and build what sells. And it seems to me no coincidence at all that off-site construction has been utterly embraced by Travelodge. We've had all this conversation before, purpose-built student accommodation, social housing, by anyone who isn't investing their life savings into the product, but is staying there perhaps temporarily or perhaps only for as long as they have to.
But having said that, Phil, the volume house builders do use, in a sort of sneaky way, I suppose, modern methods of construction, because their customers want a house that looks like a house. So they want a front door, they want a window either side of it, and they want a porch and all the rest of it, and a chimney on the roof, and that you can buy glass reinforced plastic chimneys, which actually have no function at all. They just sit on top of a ridge. Most houses don't bother with chimneys these days, but if you want a chimney, you can have one, but it's just to look like a chimney. You can your porch can be prefabricated, again, out of timber and glass-reinforced plastic, and that's delivered to site as a finished product and just screwed to the wall around the door.
But as are window frames. I mean, a fully glazed window frame comes in with a UPVC surround and it's fitted in. So parts of that, many, many, many parts of a house. The bricks are made in factories, let's not forget. lots of things are made in
the original modular construction material.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think it's because, and this is why the industry doesn't like us calling them prefabs, because it has a sort of a shabby connotation. It sounds like it's something cobbled together in a workshop, and it's temporary, it's flimsy, it's not really habitable. Yeah, people we talk about bricks and mortar. We still talk about bricks and mortar when we're talking about residential property, and that's what the buying public wants. They want something. They want to feel like they're buying a solid, traditionally built house, even if it isn't traditionally built or even solid. So I think the house builders have to sort of walk a fine line between marketing their products as traditional family homes, we're Tudor Bethan type, half timbered type things, or a Georgian townhouse, whatever it happens to be, but building them using cost effective prefabricated components. And so there is a role for modern methods of construction, and there has been for many, many years in the housing sector. It's just that you've got to be careful how you describe it. So I think that's probably what's held them back. I'm not at all surprised that Persimmon's quite interested in getting deeper into off-site manufacture and modern methods of construction, because it's cost-effective and it's much quicker to build.
Well, it'd be interesting to see how much deeper Persimmon will stick its hand in its pocket, because £25 million is more than small change to you and I, David, but to Persimmon it's not much. And I don't think it'll be long before Top Hat come back to his shareholders. And Persimmon will have to look again to see whether it wants to stump up deeper and go deeper, because it's in the house building business. Goldman Sachs is only in the money making business. Yeah. It's not interested in houses, it's interested in money. That's its business model, that's its business. So ultimately, Goldman Sachs are looking to Persimmon and say, oh, is this our exit strategy?
Yeah.
Can we get more out of it? Well, they're going to want $500 million to, you know, for what they put in it if they're not going to be stupid. But I find we've talked about this whole offsite construction, prefabs and everything, and I know I'm on the wrong side of fashion in this argument and being slightly fearful about it and suspecting that there will be a building scandal down the road and within the next 10 years. Well, questions will be asked about the headlong rush to offsite construction. But we've talked about that before. What I find really interesting is this aspect that ISG found in buying a company which it saw as a supplier and acquiring a supplier. And it's kind of the flip side of what we've seen in the plant hire side. And I'm thinking particularly of when Thinning, the Caterpillar dealer, bought Hudens back in 2001. Hudens Stewart it then was.
Big plant hire, of course.
Hudens Stewart, I think it was stock market listed at that time, I think. And Thinning took it private. Thinning, Canadian company, Caterpillar dealer in Canada and UK, Ireland. Not sure what other territories it's got, but you know, a big organisation. And they figured that if they bought Hudens Stewart, they would be able to sell shed loads of Cat machines because they had the biggest, I don't know, was Hudens the biggest rental company at the time?
It was either the biggest or the second biggest.
It was the biggest in, or one of the biggest in, across the board. It might not have been the biggest in tool hire or the biggest in earth movers, but it had everything.
Yeah.
So Thinning paid 322 million quid for Hudens Stewart in 2001. Hudens suddenly started buying lots of Caterpillar machines, whether its customers wanted them or not, because its business decision making was determined by who owned it, not by what its customers wanted. Immediately a bad move. And it stopped buying machines from other people, by and large. So the upshot was, this is bad for Hudens Stewart's business. Thinning couldn't sell machines to anyone apart from Hudens Stewart. And by 2010, 9 years later, Thinning realised the error of its ways and offloaded Hudens Stewart for 110 million, a third what it bought for it. I mean, it did get some money back. It had sold, along the way, it had sold the tool hire business to Speedy for 115 million. And it had sold the tower crane business to Harrington's for, I don't think that sum was ever disclosed, but a wodge. But it's not entirely clear that Thinning got its money's worth from Hudens Stewart. It didn't work out terribly well. And there are other examples in the States where when the rental business for plant hire for construction machinery and cranes first started up in much later than in the UK, where the distributors, who often weren't factory owned, they were independent companies who specialised in as being distribution companies for the manufacturers, got into the hire business because the lot of contractors were increasingly saying, we don't want to buy that machine, but we'd like to borrow it for a few months and give you some money. And that kind of made it rather inhibited the development of the hire sector, because if the distributors were hiring out machines, and when the hire company would go along and say, well, if I buy some machines from you for my hire fleet and go to a contractor to hire them, I'm in competition with your hire business. And people had to sort of work out exactly what they are and what their business is. Now, Persimmon is clearly a house builder, and Top Hat is a house builder. They're in the same business and they fit together. But, you know, ISG and ESS found that although they were both in the construction, you know, in the building game, they recognized very quickly it wasn't going to work together in the same way that, you know, Thinning and Hudens didn't. Now, sometimes, can, when Hudens Stewart, the tower cranes business, was the distributor for Wolf, the German tower crane.
Wolf, the German,
But that's a slightly different story, because basically you only really had, less than half a dozen major tower crane owners, and there are about half a dozen tower crane manufacturers. So we sort of had a situation in the UK where every tower crane hire company represented a manufacturer. So, you know, Select cranes were all white because they were Terex Commodore, or Pioneers a bit, but basically Terex tower cranes. Hewden's, then Harrington's, HTC were all red because they were all Wolf. And actually, Wolf now own that hire business in the fleet in the UK. And others teamed up with others to a greater or lesser extent.
Yeah.
But it's a much smaller market. There are fewer customers. And if you were a tower crane manufacturer and you could own a UK fleet, it was probably a better bet than for Finning to own a plant hire company, because it's a much wider spread of customers, much more diffuse.
Yeah. Still, I mean, it does, I suppose these are sort of hidden conflicts of interest, which you don't, you know, people haven't really discovered until they start trying to make the system work. Then they find out their customers are a bit ambivalent about it. You can understand how that happens. I mean, it does sound like a good idea. There are companies, still smaller companies now, who are both dealers and, you know, they'll sell you a digger and they'll hire you a digger. But they tend to be small companies working on a local basis. They're not, you know, large suppliers of construction equipment selling equally to hire companies and to contractors. They tend to hire out what's sitting in the yard, and they'll sell you anything out of the yard if you want to buy it.
But business 101, you don't compete with your customers.
No.
And if you start competing with your customers are not going to be your customers.
No, of course.
But where that leaves Persimmon with Top Hat, whether Top Hat ever had any hope or expectation to sell units to, you know, Barrett, or I was going to say Bovis, Vistry they now are, couldn't remember that one. Or Barclay, or the other volume house builders. Maybe that was never their game plan. Maybe they see Persimmon as a big enough outfit that if they only sell to Persimmon, Bob's your uncle, home and dry.
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting to see how it works out.
Well, I think also there's a question about where the offsite sector fits into the house building market. Is it a supplier to building firms, or is it a building firm itself?
Yes.
I can't think of a single Top Hat development anywhere. I imagine there must be some, but I've no idea how many houses they've built, and I've never heard of a development being branded as a Top Hat development. You know, come and buy, you know, a development of prefabs, which is what a lot of people would consider them to be.
Well, they're too tiny. They've only made a few hundred so far. Well, they did 12 million of business last year, so they're not yet big enough for that.
No.
But Ilke, we've reported on the Construction Index news site, have started to act as developer.
That's true.
They've bought sites and put up. But, you know, we're talking developments of 10 or 20 houses. We're not talking about, you know, new towns or anything.
No.
But we reported just a couple of months ago that Top Hat took a £50 million order from Man GPM for 226 units on a farm property, Old Malling Farm, in Lewes in Sussex. Mm-hmm. So Man is basically acting as the developer, and Top Hat is going to deliver and install the houses on site. I don't know who takes responsibility, whether there be a project manager involved for, you know, preparing the land and doing the, you know, putting in the infrastructure for the site. I can't imagine Top Hat's going to manage the infrastructure.
Well, they won't be in site preparation or plumbing or anything like that. So they'll have to have a contractor in to do that, I imagine, and to connect them all up once they're in place. But I suppose Top Hat, simply they make the houses and deliver them to site, and there's a site team that locates them, I suppose, rather than builds them.
So that 226 units, I can't remember a bigger single site with volumetric factory-built housing in one place that comes to my mind, that I've read about or been told about on that one.
No, me neither.
And that starts next year sometime in Lewes, the site preparation starts. So if the customer base is all people like, you know, investment firms like Man and Legal in general, similar sort of, you know, it's a money outfit, insurance outfit. It's building its own houses in its factory in where did I say it was, near Selby. So maybe that's what the customer base is for Top Hat, and it's not Persimmon's competitors at all, and therefore the model is sound.
I can't quite understand this. This is just me thinking aloud, really, that because off-site manufacture, prefabrication, call it what you like, has been around for an awfully long time. And again, 20 years ago, it was the next big thing. Hasn't really quite got there yet. So it's not new. It's not entirely new, although some of the methods might be fairly new. How come they soak up so much money and produce so little product? That's what puzzles me. I mean, Top Hat, and you mentioned Ilke Homes. They both had an enormous amount of investment poured into them. Is it simply that the factories they're building, and the factories can't be high tech? It's not like they're building computers or iPhones or anything like that.
They're not building computers, but the CGIs of Top Hat's Corby factory has got lots of robots pictured in it, laser cutters and so on. So, you know, it's all automated production, which if they're going to be building at volume, at speed, you'd expect it to be. And that costs a lot of money. But I suspect, given the lack of journalist access to these factories, that there are across the board probably, I don't want to say problems, but yeah, learning curves, let's call them, that are still being worked on.
Well, as you said earlier, there have been several off-site manufacturers, prefabrication factories, which have opened and closed over the years. So people have found it difficult to, you know, get this sort of venture off the ground, partly because of the market isn't ready for it, partly because I suppose the cost, if it is that expensive, then that's a major obstacle you've got to overcome.
Yes, and I think there's been a lot of frustration amongst the volumetric house builders at the market resistance, at the insurance companies, the mortgage lenders, insurance companies, I mean, legal and general are completely there, left, right, and centre. But
getting a mortgage on a prefab isn't easy. Let's put it that way.
Until people like me go, yep, that's what I want.
Yeah.
They're using your likes of, you know, your TV grand design type people and your TV architects who go around the place saying, oh, look at this beautiful factory made house. So there are celebrity influencers that they're that are pushing the case for them.
Yeah.
And at grand designs level, I think there are lots of people who would like to live in a big glass box.
Not quite the same as selling to the mass market, though, which is, of course, is what Persimmon does.
Yes. So streets and streets and streets of rabbit hutches.
They won't thank you for saying that, Phil, but we all know what you mean. So watch this space, see what they do with it.
Now, what's this I hear about you going sailing, David? I didn't know you were a sailor.
Oh, yeah. Well, I haven't been sailing for an awfully long time. My dad was a very keen sailor. He had boats, and I used to go out. And I used to go out with a girl who was a keen sailor. And it's too cold and wet for me most of the time, so I stopped doing it. But no, I went out. The idea was to sail from North Devon up to Porlock and back, go up with the tide and come down with the tide. Friend of mine's got
Porlock's in Somerset, in Bristol Town.
In Somerset, yeah. So the other side of Exmoor, basically. So it would have been a nice little trip. Friend of mine's got a Wayfarer, which is a 16-foot sailing dinghy, more than capable of doing a trip like that. So, yeah, so we went out on Saturday.
Is that just with a strip of canvas or a proper motor?
Oh, no. No. Well, we did have a motor, actually. It's a sailing dinghy. But, we got it. We managed to get out into the Bristol Channel, and then there was no wind. So we motored back, which was very unsatisfying. But never mind. We'll do it sometime anyway.
I've never got the hang of sailing. I've never really tried it. I once tried on a lake on a holiday one time, windsurfing. And I just about managed to stand up on the board. And the instructor said, well, you just have to turn the board, angle the sail to catch the wind. And I kept leaning this way and that way. And I must have gone 360 degrees round, and no wind went into my sail at all. And there's nothing wrong with the weather. People all around me were bombing around on their windsurfers. And I think it must have been, I was just so heavy, the board wouldn't move. I just couldn't get any wind in my sails. And thereby is probably the story of my life.
Well, I think if windsurfing was your first introduction to sailing, was probably not the place to start. And you want to start in a little dinghy, which is fairly stable and relatively dry, and you're unlikely to fall off it. I've only ever been windsurfing once, many years ago. I went windsurfing in March on a gravel pit in Chigwell. And I didn't have a wetsuit, and I fell in several times, and I vowed never to do it again. So I never have. But sailing's different.
But your Porlock trip, if there's no wind, did you never leave North Devon, or was it just
no?
A slog?
We didn't. We started off at a place called Watermouth, which is a lovely little cove, and we managed to get about as far as Coombe Martin, which I think is probably about 3 miles up the coast.
I think I've been to Coombe Martin. I've heard of that.
Well, yeah. And we managed to get to Coombe Martin, and then there was no wind. And so we thought, well, in a bit, the tide will change and it'll carry us back down, but we need to get back in again. So we started the outboard motor and just pootled back in. It was all right. I had nothing else to do on Saturday, so it was great. So, no, we're going to do it. We had planned originally, next week there was an organised flotilla of wayfarers going over to Lundy. And that was the original plan, but we can't do that now, so we're not going to go to Lundy. But that would have been fun.
I suppose sailing's a bit like golf, in that the worse you are, the more value you get for your money.
How does that work in golf?
Well, if you're really good, you only get to hit the ball about 60 times.
Oh, I see.
Whereas yeah, I get to hit it loads of times.
Yeah.
Much
yeah,
better.
Okay. No, I see. I take your point. Yes, that's probably true with sailing. Yeah, if you're not a very good sailor, there's an awful lot of activity and you don't go very far. And that was really what happened to us on Saturday. So there we are.
Right. You're going to be in London on Saturday?
No, I'm not.
Westminster Abbey.
I'm dog-sitting for somebody who is going to be there. No, we're staying here. I've got plenty to get on with in the garden, so I shan't be going up to London, and I shan't be sitting in front of the telly.
You turned down the invitation to attend, then.
Didn't actually arrive, Phil, but you know what the post is like these days. So what about you? What are you doing next weekend? We've got another bank holiday, of course.
Another bank holiday again. Well, it's a weekend, therefore it's a bank holiday weekend in May. Yeah. I'll probably have the telly on, but we've got some neighbours around in the afternoon to for the post match analysis to talk about who played well and who dropped the ball a bit in the big event. Unfortunately, rain is forecast, so
yes.
we'll be stuck indoors.
That'll make it even more exciting. Yeah, maybe that's a good reason to sit in front of the telly then.
Right, well, we'll be back again in 2 weeks' time. So thank you, everyone, once again, for listening to Reconstruction. You can get in touch with us, as always, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. You know where to find us because you're listening to us and you've got this far. And if you've got this far, you either love to hate us or you hate to love us. So subscribe, leave us a review if you're in a place where you can leave reviews, and we will be back again in 2 weeks' time. So from David and I, thank you very much and goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.